From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome back to The Advice Show. This week, we've got Kevin Wood from Watson Wood and Szilard joining us. Kevin, welcome. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Julian.
Just want to say once again, congratulations on being named one of NMA's top 100 firms. It's richly deserved. I thought we could maybe start by casting our eyes back over the past year and asking sort of what steps you and Kirsty have taken to advance the business from where it was a year ago.
Yeah, well, for completeness, myself, Kirsty, and Alan. So Alan's the third director and owner of the business. And the last year has actually been a fairly busy one for us. We've built on the team, adding two new financial planners. So one who joined us from another firm, and one who has moved on from administrator to paraplanner and now trainee planner. We've also added an experienced administrator and a receptionist, so four new members of staff in the last year. Outside of that, we've now expanded our offering into Aberdeen as well, so we've added a third office location through in Aberdeen, which has been a big step for us. We already have a handful of clients through that way that we've just obtained organically, and now we're looking to build on that with a location through there, an office space, and start to maybe expand our client base in the region. So a really busy team for us over the last 12 months.
And that I noted in your entry, that sort of expansion of the business comes largely through bringing on staff members because you want to limit each planner to 50 families. Is that correct? What can you explain a little bit about why that is?
Yeah, so our feel is that a lot of the clients we look after tend to be quite complicated.
Yeah.
So we don't feel that we can do that as a volume business. So looking at the numbers, we felt that about 50 families per advisor on average was probably a level where we can be quite proactive and spend more time on those clients than perhaps you would on the average kind of client. Within that, we have about 245 to 250 families at the moment. So that's not clients, that's families. And we have 6/7 advisors. So we're still well within those kind of parameters. And it seems to have worked for us. We found over the last almost 9 years that this has been going, that we've been able to offer a really bespoke personal service to each of those clients. And to put that into context, Julian, there was a business that sold in our region maybe 2-3 years ago, which advertised that across two planners, they had 900 clients.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, an average of 450. That's not necessarily wrong. You know, they might just have a more simplified offering, or you may see a lot of clients that are just doing ISAs each year. Ours are far more involved, and we just don't think we could work with those sorts of numbers.
Yeah, and why? What are some of the, if you can divulge these details, I suppose, what are some of the sort of complicated factors that some clients have, sort of difficult trust issues, or what are the?
Yeah, there can be trusts, there can be inheritance tax planning.
Yeah,
You'll often find that it's multiple tax wrappers or you know, business, different income streams. So there's lots of different tax considerations, and you're trying to manage the income tax implications, the investment implications, the inheritance tax implications, and often multi-generational as well. So on the back of the budget last year, when there was changes proposed for business relief and agricultural relief, we've had a lot of discussions and meetings with clients about possibly moving business assets down the generations. So that involves not just speaking to the client, but bringing in their accountant and solicitor, speaking to the next generation about how that's going to affect them. And that's obviously much more complicated than just maybe setting up an ISA of a year.
Yeah.
So those are quite typical of the complications we see in our client bank.
The government gave you quite a tough year last year with numerous things in the budget, the IHT changes as well.
They really did. And I think from October until the end of last year, we were run off our feet with clients wanting to understand what that meant for them. the pension changes that were proposed as well. But you've got to flip that around and say, you know, that's why we're here. And those are the sort of instances where we can really add value and improve our worth.
Yeah. When the business was first founded, I mean, what was the sort of pitch to the clients that you guys wanted? What is the general client base?
Yeah, it was really that limited client numbers. You know, we made known to clients that that's what we're looking to do. We were looking to set up a business where we were keeping the numbers down and being as proactive as we can. Some clients had worked with us already and understood, you know, what that meant. But new clients coming in, we very much made the point that you'll see a lot more from us than you might from an advisor if your relationship is just a coffee and a Kit Kat once a year. We try to be as involved across the year as we possibly can be.
Yeah. And beyond, I suppose, the changes from the government last year and in general at budgets, what are some of the biggest challenges you guys face as business owners slash advisors as well?
Our biggest challenge, like a lot of firms, is getting the right people in the right roles. And being remote, you know, we're in the north of Scotland. There isn't a large kind of base of ready qualified people we can pull into to role. So we really have to have a really defined 5-year plan where we know what resource we need next year and the year after and the year after. And we start to look at how we're going to fill those roles. And sometimes it is bringing someone in externally. And sometimes it's bringing people through from different parts of the business into planning roles and technical roles. But if you don't plan ahead and you don't really think about how you're going to put people into place, then you'll either end up being too stretched with the business you have, or you'll have to in some way soft close the business and say, you know, we're at our maximums and we can't really take on anything else. And we don't want to do that. We want to be able to take on the next 50 families and the next 50 families. So that's kind of an ongoing challenge for us and for a lot of firms, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's better to grow your staff count than limit the clients you can take on. You noted, I suppose, similar to that, is that you guys try and take on a school leaver every other year. What's that sort of aspect of the business and what does that deliver for you guys?
So we have, and not just school leavers, it could be a college leaver as well, potentially. That's been a really challenging one for us. We've been into schools to present on behalf of the industry, so on behalf of the Trust Insurance Institute and as Watson Wood as well. We've done career fairs. We've worked with an organisation called Developing Young Workforce, which looks at trying to encourage school leavers into industry. But there's still a real lack of awareness from school leavers as to the options. And I would actually say a real lack of awareness from the schools themselves. You know, we're speaking to teachers and people that are in kind of guidance roles in the schools, and they don't understand our industry. They don't understand what the options are. So you're almost having to do an educational piece on the career opportunities with the staff themselves, even before you get to the children. And then for those that we've taken in, we've advertised a new role probably every year to 2 years as a junior coming in to learn the role. And I would say that every year we maybe only get 1 to 2 applicants, no matter how much we do. Yeah. And I think part of that is that a lot of children feel they have to go to further education, which is not wrong. You know, it might be that that's the right career path for some. And then for others, it might just be a lack of awareness of the opportunity. So we really have to push that one to try and get people to apply for the roles, to then bring them in.
Where do you sort of advertise the roles beyond schools themselves?
It's primarily schools and Developing Young Workforce, which works with the schools. So we're not just doing it as an online kind of job recruitment site. We're going directly to them. And we're asking the guidance staff at the schools, do you know people that might suit these roles? And we've also done that to the college, and that's been more successful. We've had some really good applicants from the college, but the schools were starting at a lower base and we're really having to work that one. And we'd ideally like it to work because we'd love to offer more opportunities for people at that age to come in and develop, possibly do qualifications and to work their way through like we've had some staff do over the years.
Yeah. And I suppose what, I mean, some of the success stories from that initiative, could you talk me through some of them?
Yeah. So the bigger success stories we've had has been from college. So people that are maybe slightly further on than school leavers. And we've had two or three staff now, three actually, who have come in with college qualifications and have worked up one to office manager. So one lady came in as an administrator, junior administrator, developed a senior administrator, and is now the office manager, having gone down that role rather than planning. And we've also had one who's went on to senior paraplanner, coming in junior administrator, administrator, senior paraplanner. So they're going into the technical side. And I think that's a great thing about it as well. Once you come in, you can go into whichever avenue you want. Do you want to go into people management? Do you want to go into kind of the HR side? Or do you want to carry on to the technical side, whether to paraplanner or carrying on to planner? And we're offering those opportunities to whoever comes in. So I think as well, we try to emphasize that once you come into the firm, you can choose the path that suits you once you've seen what the different kind of work types are. And those two people have went in different directions and developed their career with progression into different areas.
Yeah. And what advantages do you think that gives you as a business over, I suppose, perhaps larger competitors who don't run such initiatives, perhaps are able to employ people with more experience?
I don't know if I would say that larger competitors don't do that, Julian, because okay. I think larger companies probably have more opportunities in different areas. You know, if you look at national companies, they probably have opportunities to go into different departments than a smaller company. But I think what we're trying to do there is equalize the job progression that you would see in a large business and a relatively small business. So we have 19 staff now, and that's still a relatively small business. You know, you're not going to have all the opportunities you have in a national firm. But we're trying to give staff as many of them as we possibly can, so that there is progression. And you need to offer that, I think, to get the best staff.
Yeah, absolutely. Just onto the business, and you and I speak quite regularly about your investment proposition for clients, particularly in light of tariffs over a month ago now. Could you talk the listeners through some of Botts & Wood's investment proposition?
Yeah, so I think what sits above the investment strategy is a plan for the client and how they're going to deal with these instances of volatility. And that period we had in sort of February into March, where markets were really volatile, we emphasised to clients in advance of those that their plan is set up to deal with that scenario. We often keep some money in cash within portfolios, and you know, we also suggest clients keep quite a bit of cash themselves often, so that they can turn to that in periods where the stock market might be down. But we also do calculations to show clients how much they can withstand in terms of volatility. And we put that in numerical terms. So we may say to a client, you know, based on these assumptions, your portfolio of £1 million could fall by £500,000, 50%, and you'd still be okay. And then we emphasize these calculations every time we meet, so that when they see an instance where the stock market's falling a few percent, the portfolio's fallen a few percent, they know that that's well within the realms of what they can withstand. And I think that education is really important for clients, especially new investors who maybe haven't gone through these periods before. It just gets them comfortable with what's happening around them and allows them to sit back and just realize that this is part of the journey and it doesn't cause them any problems. Within the portfolios then, we tend to have 18 to 20 collective funds within a portfolio, a mixture of active and passive investments. And we tend to go for single asset class funds, so that in volatile periods, if there's an extended volatile period, there is scope to sell down particular single assets so that the client can top up their cash from an asset that's not distressed. So we talk clients again through that strategy, and again that gives them confidence that if they do encounter an extended, prolonged downturn, there's things that can be done within the portfolio to mitigate that.
Mm. Could you talk me through some of the asset classes that you guys are particularly attracted to at the moment?
We're attracted to all asset classes.
All asset classes.
We're diversified. I think we're quite vanilla. So we will have obviously domestic and overseas equities, bonds, gilts, some infrastructure for diversification. We don't tend to hold things like gold, just because of the volatility and what's considered a kind of a hedging asset. It can be extremely volatile in itself, so we haven't tended to hold that to date. So a pretty vanilla kind of collection. I suppose the one thing that's maybe slightly different is that we don't tie ourselves to being an active investor or a passive investor. We believe that passive works very well in certain markets, particularly things like US equities, where a lot of research says that you can't beat the market there. But then we want to be active in things like bond funds, where we don't want to be having to make decisions on duration of the bond fund. We would rather, you know, someone with a lot more time and expertise does that. So we try to mix and match where we think one approach is better than the other.
Yeah, I noted in your entry, I think it's 54-46 in favour of active, I think, over passive.
It's going to be in that ballpark. It'll be somewhere between 50 and 60 active, depending on the timing. And that's not just to say getting a chunk of passive to take the cost down. It's because market to market, we believe that passive is better somewhere and active might be better somewhere else.
Yeah, sensible. I mean, can just more on sort of tech stack then, what platforms do you tend to use, DFMs as well?
Yeah, so on platforms, we start from the premise that we don't have a single platform that we put clients onto, because I think you've got to consider all options to ensure you're getting the best client outcome. So our first bit of research for any client work we're doing is, what's the most cost-effective platform for this client? You then may exclude a handful or a couple because maybe you've tried them before and they've not worked well, or there's been limitations. So you will tend to get down to a handful of platforms that are cost-effective that work well. Historically, we had a lot of clients on the Quilter platform, and that's worked very well for us, and we continue to use that one. We also have clients on Transact, Nucleus. We do business off-platform as well, Julian. So sometimes if we have clients that maybe have a pension need and don't need anything complicated, we'll just use a personal pension. And things like the Royal London personal pension work very well for a lot of those clients. But that starting point is, it's not definitely going to platform, it's not definitely going to one platform. Research the whole of market and then fine-tune it to what works. On the investment side, you asked about DFMs. We do some MPS portfolios, and DFM-wise, we probably use Aspen for them, so Albemarle. Probably better saying Aspen, because Albemarle is a bit of a mouthful when you give them their growth. we've only recently started using their portfolios, and they've been looking really good for us, and the team there have been really supportive. We started to use them. There may be more bespoke portfolios. We do some AIM portfolios for our clients who were doing inheritance tax and planning, and we'll sometimes use discretionary portfolios where clients have a really bespoke, sustainable, ethical need, you know, when they've identified something that you can't really get through a unit trust. And that might suit someone like Rathbones, who have a very good green ethical offering.
Is that sort of no cigarettes, no oil, no gas, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so you can, but we have some be really, really specific, like they want to make sure there's no sweatshops within the companies they're using, or no harm to animals within the companies they're using. And you just have to drill down that little bit more than you can with a collective fund.
Yeah.
And Rathbones, Green Bank have a very good kind of bespoke offering that tends to suit those types of clients.
It's fascinating. Onto your ESG funds then. I noted, I think you have 5 million in funds under management that qualify as ESG. Have you noticed a sort of shift in your client bank over the last 18 months? More people want turning to those sort of ESG funds or not?
So I'd much? Actually say less, Julian. Do you know, we had a period maybe 3 years ago, 4 years ago, where lots of clients were asking about sustainability and ESG. And it was maybe just more prevalent in the press at that time. And we were getting a lot of inquiries about possibly putting a portion of portfolios or all portfolios into there. Over the last couple of years, that's definitely reduced. And I don't know if that's because those types of portfolios saw a lot more volatility 2-3 years ago than a broader portfolio. Because when you had the the invasion, the Ukraine invasion, portfolios that didn't hold oil and gas suffered more than those that did. And I don't know if maybe that experience has meant that people are weighing up, yeah, I do like that, but do I like it at the expense of my financial security? And we're definitely seeing people asking about it less, or even ones that are in there thinking, do they get an approach where they maybe have a bit of both just to edge their bets? But certainly the demand for it's reduced.
That's very interesting. Do you expect it to tick up again, or do you think it's all performance related, and also, I suppose, what the coverage is in the national press as well?
Perhaps. It's hard to say if it will tick up, because obviously you've seen a lot of firms amending how they market their funds because of the hoops they've got to jump through to use the sustainable titles. So it seems like, to me, the investment universe has kind of just stepped back a bit itself from marketing ESG solutions. And if that happens, then the demand you would expect will come down a little bit as well, because there'll be less of an awareness about it and what the options are out there. But it'll be interesting to see over the next couple of years what the trend is, whether that continues, or whether when ESG funds start performing well again, investment funds get on the front foot and clients then start to ask more about it again.
Yeah, one thing that I did think was really interesting in your entry was the writing around consumer duty and the fact that you're quite a young business, which meant that you didn't have that many changes to make when it was enacted. Kevin, would you be able to talk us through a little bit about why that is? I think you say that it didn't have a large material impact. And
well, I think when you're starting a business afresh, you have an opportunity to look at all your processes and what you would do ideally. And so when we started, and we had a number of months where we were setting up, we weren't quite live. And that gives you the opportunity to look at all your systems, all your processes, how you want to work as a firm. And when we did that, we brought in the 50 client model that I mentioned. And that in its own's quite a good one for consumer duty, because we felt when we looked and reviewed at what we were offering those clients, because we have more time, we have more interactions with clients through the year, and that allowed us to demonstrate the value that we're offering to clients that use our services. We also have a service, Julian, where for clients that don't need an ongoing service, we will quite happily do transactional work where it's not to the client's detriment. So if you came to us as a 45-year-old with £150,000 in your pension and no big life events coming up, there's a good chance that you don't need an ongoing service. And we'll happily set you up with a pension plan that meets your objectives, and then just say to you, we're not going to add fees, you're not a client after this is done, but come back to us if something changes in your circumstances. And I think having that service as well really helps us with consumer duty, because it shows that you're meeting a client need. You're not forcing them into a service that meets your need. So again, having that from the outset really helped us as well.
Yeah, sorry to jump around again. Just earlier, I meant to ask about, you mentioned AIM portfolios. Have you seen any downturn in clients wanting to use them? The government slashed in half the inheritance tax break on them.
In terms of downturning clients, we wouldn't tend to get clients asking for those themselves. Really, that's us recommending them, because you know, a client might not be aware that AIM is a solution that they can use to reduce their inheritance tax. What we've definitely seen, though, is the investment companies that offer those tend to also offer business relief strategies, which go into unlisted companies, which will retain the £1 million exemption going forward. And the businesses that are offering both those solutions are very much on the front foot and offering their business relief solution just now. What we've not done as a firm, we've not rotated clients from AIM into business relief solutions at this stage. And we're aware that some companies are promoting that. You know, why don't you rotate them in whilst you can still get the 100% relief? And then going forward, you have business relief strategies rather than AIM strategies. We always liked AIM as a business relief solution when it had the full relief, because it's a diversified portfolio of those companies. And if we go into a business relief strategy going forward and an unlisted company, you'll tend to find you're in one company, which will be set up in a way that you hope mitigates the chances that one company can lose all its value, but you're still in one company. So at the moment, our thinking is for those clients that have already got AIM portfolios, we're going to retain those to benefit from the 50% relief in most instances. And then we'll monitor what happens in the landscape, whether reliefs stay the same when they come into force in 2026, and whether there's any changes beyond that that mean we have to think about whether we come out of AIM. But I think it's still worthwhile to get the 50% relief for clients that have really large inheritance tax issues that can't deal with it elsewhere.
Yeah, and as long as they're performing, I suppose. Can I ask Kevin?
Well, that's another thing. Yeah. They've had a really tough time of it the last few years, AIM portfolios. When you look at the underlying figures, the multiple some of those companies are trading on are really attractive in their own right. You take out the relief, you could make a case that on investment valuations, those companies may come good and give good returns in the future as well.
Yeah. I suppose the big story in financial services world over the last week has been the government's reported teetering with ISAs. Have you had any sort of concerns from clients, or are you guys concerned about them potentially slashing the cash ISA allowance?
Yeah, clients have asked about it. And I, from my perspective, I don't think it's concerning. I think, you know, it would be going back to where we were a number of years ago, where the cash ISA allowance was lower than the overall ISA allowance. And by the looks of things, you would be able to marry up the two. So if the cash ISA allowance gets reduced, you could use that and then top up the investment ISA. I can see the rationale in it and trying to get people investing again. Where I'm not sure of the value is I think Rachel Reeves would like to see people put more money into UK businesses. And if we can get people investing through ISAs more, maybe that will filter its way through to boosting UK businesses. But that's kind of counter to the effect you'll have had by reducing the allowances on AIM stocks. So AIM stocks will be real UK businesses, not FTSE 100 companies that are investing globally. And by reducing that allowance, I think you've probably led to money coming out of UK businesses, or certainly not going in as much. So I can understand why she would want to do it. I don't think it'll be massively to the detriment of clients, but I'm not sure it's going to achieve what
the government wanted to achieve. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's close to the end now, Kevin, but I just wanted to ask, I mean, what has been some of the best decisions you think you've taken to develop the business? Obviously, it's an enormously successful business now and definitely a success story of the advice world, of the IFA world, rather.
I think the way we run the business with the 50 client model has been to our benefit. You know, when we speak to professional connections locally, so solicitors, accountants, you know, a lot of our clients come from those professionals. And when we emphasize our model and you know, how we can deal with complicated cases by keeping the numbers down, that really seems to strike a chord. So right from the outset, you know, pinning our hopes on having that model and perhaps turning down business that maybe doesn't suit that model has really been helpful. And that's not easy because as you go along year to year, you'll often get people get in touch who you feel we can't really add value to based on our fee structure and they wouldn't fit in with what we do. So being able to say no to things that don't fit, to stick to your guns there has really been to our benefit. That's been challenging at times as well, because as I say, recruitment is the hardest thing. So there is always a temptation to say, well, do we just kind of 60 or 70 and we don't take on the next planner? But to date, we've really been quite methodical and planning ahead for when we need that next planner and getting them
disciplined about it as well. I suppose it takes that, doesn't it?
What was that? Sorry, Julian?
Being disciplined as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's not wrong to say that there would be a model for more clients per advisor. It's just not the model we want to go for. And I think it's worked for us to date. It's worked for us with professional connections. And I think it's worked for the clients as well, who've seen a different service than they could have had if we had double the number of clients. I think we'll stick to that going forward. And I think that will probably be what drives the company.
Fantastic. And I suppose moving forward, where do you guys hope the business will be in 12 months, 18 months as well?
So I would love to see the offering in Aberdeen take off and us being able to help more clients in Aberdeen. We have an advisor, Martin Percival, who's based through there full time. So it'd be great to keep Martin busy. So he's not
twiddling his thumbs a bit.
I think he'd like that as well. He'd like to travel. I'm sure he'd like to be more busy in Aberdeen. So we'd love to see the offering take off there. And that's not volume. because as we say, you know, it's only a small number of clients that, that we're looking for. And I would just like to be able to see us being able to carry on to fill the next advisor and the next advisor and grow organically in that way. I think from our perspective, Julian, you report a lot, you know, on the number of takeovers in the business, the amount of consolidation. We see it locally. You know, there's been a number of good firms that have been bought over the last 12 months in our area, which means that as an independent and locally based firm, we're one of very few now. But I think that can be a real benefit to us. I think clients do like to deal with people they know. And I think coming into our firm and then comparing us to someone that's maybe owned nationally, there could be a real advantage to sell that we're locally owned and run, and you'll know the people you're dealing with.
Well, people increasingly in a sort of globalized world enjoy a sort of bespoke offering, don't they? Bespoke offering, I think.
I think so.
Whether that's in your professional life or your personal life or leisure activities, whatever.
Yeah. And I think, I don't know if this is unique to where we are in the north of Scotland, but in Inverness and Elgin, where we have two of our offices, people will know you through other people often. So when they come in to see you, they're trying to place you in terms of their own connections and who they might be able to check on your credentials. You maybe don't get that to the same extent in bigger cities. You know, if you're an advisor in London, I would think that you're probably quite anonymous to a lot of the clients when they first come to see you. You're not going to have that in Inverness and Elgin. So being able to build on your local reputation up here, for better or worse, you know, if you don't do well, it's
you're on the hook if it doesn't go well, I think.
So that can be a real advantage to us, I think, and one we've really leveraged.
Fantastic. Kevin Wood, that was amazing. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem at all. Nice to speak to you, Julian.
Nice to speak to you too.
From jet engines to space rockets, telephones to computers, the world has seen spectacular change in the last 100 years, and the pace of progress is getting faster and faster. From electric cars to the metaverse, drone deliveries to climate solutions and genetic sequencing, we're investing in the companies that are not just changing the world today, but are also shaping the future. The Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Invest in progress. Capital at risk.